Recently, a restaurateur purchased one bluefin tuna fish from a Tokyo fish market for $55,700. This kind of feeding frenzy led marine biologist Barbara Tuck to call bluefin tuna the cocaine of the seas, and leads us to ask, can farming fish save wild fish?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 601st edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Luzerne who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Producer Carol Stafford.
Hello.
Parmley Taff.
Hello.
And daughter Kelsey Olson.
Hey, Dad.
Getting ready to go back to school.
Woohoo!
Woohoo! Nick Mascagno.
How's it going out there?
Folks, tuna are among the most magnificent fish in the sea. And the bluefin is, by most accounts, the most magnificent tuna of all. Beginning in Japan, people around the world have developed a passion for eating the bluefin that seems to border on the maniacal, as evidenced by the prices being paid for the red flesh of this sleek sea creature. As is the case with cocaine, mania begets more mania, and consequently, each bluefin tuna is now worth tens of thousands of dollars. Barring a sudden change in our appetite, nothing will stop the slaughter of bluefins, as there is simply too much money to be made. And so we ask, can farming save our wild fish? Here to help us troll for an answer, we have Richard Ellis, who is the author of Tuna, A Love Story. Welcome to the Food Chain, Richard.
Thank you.
A love story?
Well, everybody loves tuna, you see. I do, because I think it's a wonderful, magnificent fish. Most people love it in one form or another because they like to eat it. Mm-hmm. The Japanese, on the other hand, love it to death.
And that's what Oscar Wilde said, right?
Oscar Wilde said everyone kills the thing he loves, but I'm not so sure he was referring to tuna fish.
Well, a quick story for you, Richard. some years ago, was out fishing for wahoo down along an island group called the Revilla Hijedo, a couple hundred miles south of Cabo San Lucas out there in the Pacific Ocean. And late at night, we were anchored in the lee of one of these islands, and as we had a want to do, we threw a line into the water and see what we could catch. And one night, one of us caught a giant tuna. It was a magnificent creature, which seems to be the adjective used to describe these fish. And fought it for a long time, and we finally drug it aboard and didn't really know what to do with it. You know, the extent of our knowledge of tuna was probably tuna fish sandwiches or something like that. But the next day, the crew of this fishing boat prepared us a nice platter of red raw tuna meat. And we, of course, not being tuned into raw tuna, kind of turned up our nose to it, and the crew said, "Do you want the fish?" And we said, "Well, no, we don't want that fish. You guys can have it." Did we screw up?
Well, it depends on how long ago it was. you couldn't have taken that fish and sold it for hundreds of thousands of dollars, certainly not on the dock in the Revilla Hijedo Island.
Right.
And trying to drag it back to wherever you were out of, someplace in Baja, probably wouldn't have a lot of potential buyers there. So I think the only place you might have screwed up is in not eating it. But it's hard to imagine. I assume this was a Mexican crew.
Well, actually, it wasn't. It was an American crew. And they froze that tuna, and I took it back to...
Well, the likelihood is, and I can't tell certainly from here, but the likelihood is it was a yellowfin tuna. And yellowfin get to be quite big. They get to be 400 or 500 pounds. So... That's, the chances are that's what it was.
Probably.
And it was good for grilling, and it's good for sashimi, and a lot of people eat it raw. In fact, that's what most people eat when they order sushi or sashimi in a restaurant in California. Largely because bluefin tuna is so precious that most of it goes to Japan.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the bluefin tuna. Record price for a bluefin tuna, $173,000 for one fish. True?
True, absolutely true. And it was a 440-pound fish, and it was sold in the Tsukiji Fish Market in Tokyo for $173,000. And if you think about it, well, if I tell you about it, the fish was a frozen fish, so that the $173,000 was paid before it got chopped up into smaller pieces and sold in restaurants.
So it's still like it had its head on it and its tail and its fins. And
well, people don't eat the head and the tail and the fins, but they eat what's in between.
Mm-hmm.
And the chances are that that fish chopped up into smaller sort of bite-sized pieces would have been worth easily $500,000 by the time it got to the plate, by the time it got to the restaurant. Because you can, in Japan, you can buy a piece of raw tuna about the size of, say, a deck of cards for $100. And then if you're hungry, you buy another one. And by the time you finish, you've just spent $400 in your local sushi bar.
Oof. So let's talk about the magnificent bluefin. It seems to be that we can talk about this one fish, but in all actuality, by talking about this one fish, we're talking about all of our fishes.
Well, in a manner of speaking, yes, that's true. I mean, we are looking at across the oceans. We're looking at threatened wild fish.
Mm-hmm.
There are solutions to those problems. Some of them good, some of them not so good. But as far as the specifics of the bluefin tuna is concerned, it isn't quite the same as a carp or
right.
a salmon
right.
or a mackerel, because it is much, much bigger. It is much, much more spectacular in all of its aspects. The largest bluefin tuna ever caught weighed 1,496 pounds.
Whew.
That's three-quarters of a ton, and people fish for those. And I spoke to the guy who caught it. And he said, and I asked him what it was like, and he said, well, just imagine yourself, you're leaning out of a ten-story building, trying to haul up a steak. And when you get it close, you drop it again. And then you have to haul it all the way up again, and then you drop it again. And then you drop it again. And maybe it'll break the line on its way up, and then you have nothing. It's a very substantial feat to have caught a fish that weighs three-quarters of a ton. So it's bigger, it's spectacular looking. I'm a painter as well as a writer, and I just love painting pictures of the bluefin tuna. I did the jacket illustration for my book called Tuna, A Love Story, because I wanted to have the beauty of this fish right out front. In other words, I didn't want a plate of sushi on the jacket
right,
of the
right.
book. I wanted the fish on the jacket of the book.
Well, Trevor Corson wrote a pretty interesting story called The Zen of Fish, of course, about the sushi world. But that was about sushi, and you write about tuna, and
well,
specifically the bluefin, right?
Yeah, I know Trevor, and we've been on panels together, mm-hmm. and he said to me at one point, I know the answers to the sushi questions, but if people ask me about the tuna itself, can I refer them to you? And I said, absolutely. And he did. He
Good.
Does that.
Well, we featured Trevor about a year ago, and we talked about the sushi. But let's talk about the tuna today. And one of the adjectives used to describe this fish are all superlatives, magnificent being one of the most common adjectives. What is it about the bluefin that makes it magnificent?
Well, if you will allow the use of the word design here, and I use it advisedly because I don't think anybody or any being actually designed the tuna, but in fact it is designed to be so hydrodynamically excellent that it can move through the water faster than almost any other fish. Tuna have been clocked at 55 miles an hour.
Zoom.
And I've been standing outside the big outer bay tank at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, mesmerized by they have bluefin and yellowfin tuna in that tank, and I've watched them for hours. And that's the same tank, by the way, that the Monterey Bay Aquarium puts their young white sharks
mm-hmm.
in. And at one point they were worried that the tuna, which weigh three, four times as much as the little baby white sharks, the tuna were going to injure the shark, but of course they don't. And the shark is no match for a 400-pound tuna.
I think I've had that opportunity as well, standing outside that Outer Bay tank, just in awe at these beautiful
creatures.
It's
wonderful
creatures.
To watch. Tuna are so are designed in such a way that all their fins, for example, tuck into slots. Their eyes are flush with the side of their head.
Thus they're known as
the water. I'm sorry.
Well, thus they're known as the fighter jets of the sea. We're going to have to take a quick break. Richard Ellis, author of Tuna, A Love Story. And what is it that is said about our love affair with tuna? We love them so much we kill them and eat them. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about the wild fish of the sea and our love affair with them and how we're killing them and can farming save our wild fish. We have Richard Ellis, author of Tuna, A Love Story, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back. Please do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Just think of it. One fish. That's one fish. Selling for $173,000. That fish would be the bluefin tuna. And today we are talking about the bluefin tuna with the Richard Ellis, the author of Tuna, A Love Story. Just out. Great read. Congratulations, Richard.
Thank you.
So we're talking about the bluefin and what makes it magnificent. And you're talking about how it's kind of like a fighter jet of the seas in that it can retract its fins to make itself more aerodynamic. Wow.
Well, there's a lot more to the tuna than simply speed. The tuna, as well as a couple of other fish species, like some of the larger sharks, like the great white and the mako, have what's known as a heat exchange mechanism, which means that they can circulate their warmed blood over their muscles, which enable them to warm up the muscles, and they become the equivalent of athletes that are always warmed up. And they need that, or they use that, because that enables them to become even more efficient predators. They are capable of swimming enormous distances. They cannot stop swimming, by the way. Whenever I say that, people say, yeah, like sharks, but it isn't like sharks, because sharks can stop swimming. Tuna cannot. A tuna, if it stops swimming, will drown. And I've seen drowned tuna in nets, and I'll get to the nets shortly. But they are capable of enormous speed. They are capable of swimming across the Pacific Ocean. Tuna have been tagged, and they have been tagged in California. They swim to Japan. They turn around and swim back, and they can do that in 3 weeks to a month. They can swim across the Atlantic Ocean. They migrate without stopping. They tried to build a robot tuna at MIT to try and figure out how this fish could power itself just by wagging its tail, and they failed to duplicate that ability. They tried to build one, and they had it wag its tail, and they couldn't make it go nearly as fast as a real fish can go.
Well,
so it has all these capabilities that make it sort of the fish among fish, the supreme fish of the ocean, because it's faster, bigger, prettier.
And
unfortunately, for some people, it also tastes better than other fish.
And let's talk for a moment about the blood-warming mechanism and how that makes it a more efficient predator. And, of course, that's always what determines who's boss in the sea.
Well, who's boss in the sea, obviously, is the tuna. The only rival the tuna ever has is a Mako shark, which can get almost as big. Makos don't get to weigh 1,500 pounds. They weigh about, at max, about 1,200. But still, they're very, very fast, and they can catch these tuna sometimes. But the blood-warming mechanism that the tuna and the Mako have is such that their muscles are always warmed up. In, think of it this way. A codfish swimming in the North Atlantic, say, in 40-degree water, has a body temperature of 40 degrees. A butterfly fish swimming in the Caribbean amongst the coral reefs might have a temperature of 72 degrees because that's the water temperature.
Mm-hmm.
A tuna swimming, say, in the North Atlantic in 40-degree water can have a body temperature of 80 degrees.
Wow.
And maintain it. And it's not a sudden thing. They maintain that all the time. So they are much better equipped than the fish they're chasing.
So they're warm-blooded, they're fast, they're quick, they're agile, and they're fishing for slow-moving, cold...
Well, it doesn't have to be slow-moving, because they can catch just about anything that swims. Barbara Block of Stanford, who was one of the country's foremost tuna researchers, said at one point, when she was telling the story of their being able to raise their body temperature, she said, why, they're almost mammals. And, of course, that's true, because most fish maintain a body temperature that has to do with the ambient water. Human beings and most mammals maintain a steady body temperature, and tuna can do that. It doesn't reach 96 degrees.
And they're one of three fish that can do that?
No, the swordfish does it. Many of the tuna do it, and the mako, the poor beagle, or the salmon shark on the West Coast, and the great white also do it. And these are also supreme capable predators.
Mm-hmm. And for those of us who have had the opportunity to view the tuna swimming in the Outer Bank waters of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, as you mentioned, we sit there in amazement and watch them swim in endless circles.
Well, so they swim in endless circles, but then for reasons known only to the tuna, they accelerate. Bang! And the tuna you were just looking at isn't there anymore. And it's hard to believe that a fish can move that fast because you're staring at them, and you're right. For the most part, they go around and around and around. But every once in a while, there's something that spurs them to jump, and they're gone. The fish you're looking at simply isn't there anymore.
Boom, just like that.
Yeah.
And of course, you talked about them not being able to stop ever because if they do, they'll drown. And thus they swim in endless circles, and thus they can swim from one side of the ocean to the other and keep moving and keep moving. There's one other thing I wanted to bring up, and that is their propensity to hang around objects that are hanging around in the water.
Say it again.
You talk about their tuna fishermen have long recognized that you can sometimes find tuna swimming underneath objects that are floating in the water.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the objects they used to swim beneath, and this is yellowfin particularly, one of the objects they used to swim beneath was a school of dolphins. And that wreaked havoc with the tuna populations, because that's what the tuna fishermen used to do. They used to spot the dolphins at the surface. Dolphins breathe air.
Mm-hmm.
They spotted the dolphins splashing and jumping at the surface. Then they would throw a great big purse seine around the school of dolphins at the surface, knowing that there were tuna beneath them. Then they pull in the whole net, which could have been a mile across. These are big nets. They pull in the whole net, find the tuna in it, and the dolphins, which they didn't want, so the dolphins, which were drowned by that time, they would kick them overboard. That was this tuna-dolphin problem, as it were, was the reason, the specific reason for the passage of the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972. We needed a way to stop the tuna fishermen from killing all those dolphins.
And what impact did that law have on the tuna fishery then?
Ultimately, it had a very strong impact. At first, the tuna fishermen lobbied strongly against it, saying it would put them out of business and they had to feed their families and blah, blah, blah. But the quotas went progressively down. In the 1960s, a man called Bill Perrin, then at UCLA, a graduate student, discovered that the tuna fishermen were killing 200,000 or 300,000 dolphins every year. This number was gradually reduced by the government until an allowable quota was about 21,000 dolphins as opposed to 300,000 or 400,000 every year. They figured that over the period until the effect of the Marine Mammal Protection Act that 6 or 10 million dolphins were killed by the tuna fishermen.
Wow.
And so the effect was ultimately to protect what was left of the dolphins. Taking 6 million dolphins out of a population isn't good for the population, but the effect was that the tuna aren't being fished there anymore because you can't catch them unless you fish on dolphins, so they're not being caught there. They're being caught in the western South Pacific around Samoa, where there are no, and they're not being caught by Americans. The American tuna fishing fleet is almost over. It used to be the third largest industry in San Diego, and it's pretty much over now because other countries don't have the kind of restrictions that the Americans have and can catch tuna wherever they want to. But it's easier to catch them without killing a lot of dolphins, so they do it in the western Pacific. So yes, the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the dolphin safe tuna problem did both the tuna and the dolphins a great deal of good.
Well, okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. I'm Michael Olson. Today we're talking about tuna, and we're talking about fish in general, but the bluefin tuna in particular, with Richard Ellis, the author of a brand new book, Tuna, A Love Story. And we're talking a little bit about why this fish is so magnificent and why one fish, one bluefin tuna alone, sold for $173,000. What could possibly make one fish worth $173,000 when there is a whole world of fish in the sea just waiting to be caught? So there must be some interesting things happening there, and we're going to find out with Richard Ellis when we come back. How did one fish come to be worth so much money? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1980. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson. Right back. Please do stay tuned. Well, recently, a restaurateur purchased one bluefin tuna fish from a Tokyo fish market for $55,700, but that's not a record. The record price is $173,000. This kind of feeding frenzy led marine biologist Barbara Tuck to call bluefin tuna the cocaine of the seas, and leads us to ask today, can farming fish save our wild fish? And we're talking with Richard Ellis, who is the author of the new book, Tuna, A Love Story. What on earth would cause these fish to become so desirable, Richard? Do they taste that good?
Well, it depends. They taste that good to the Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
And at the risk of sounding like a racist, and I'm not, the Japanese are the bad guys in this uh-huh. equation. The Japanese make the market for bluefin tuna. They buy virtually all the bluefin tuna caught around the world. They are caught by every country in the Mediterranean. They are farmed in every mm-hmm. country on the Mediterranean. They're caught in the North Atlantic. They're occasionally caught in the Pacific. They're caught off Australia. And virtually all these fish go to Japan.
So if I go to the sushi market here in California or Nebraska or Kansas or Florida and order sushi, I'm not going to get the bluefin, am I?
Probably not, because you could. I mean, there's a restaurant in New York that makes a specialty of selling a bluefin tuna, but the problem with it is the prefix for lunch or dinner is $600 a person. And you're guaranteed of getting bluefin tuna, which may, in fact, have been caught off the coast of Massachusetts, flown to Japan, auctioned off at the fish market in Tokyo, and then flown back to New York. That's a possibility, a very strong possibility, because the restaurant that sells this fish for $600 claims that they are the most select fish bought in Japan, but they could have been caught 100 miles from where the restaurant is. Well, the fact is that the Japanese have turned the bluefin tuna into a craze.
You called it an overdeveloped lust.
Well,
which is an interesting term.
It's people eating a specific kind of food in such quantities that is endangering the species. They're virtually eating the bluefin tuna out of existence.
What is it about the bluefin that makes it?
Well, I have eaten bluefin. When I was in Australia last year looking at the fish farms, the tuna farms down mm-hmm. in Australia, because they were catching bluefin, they would occasionally cut one up and serve it in the restaurant. And I ate it a couple of times. I couldn't not. I ate it a couple of times, and it's mushy and it's rather fishy tasting. But that's what the Japanese like. Mm-hmm. Before, say, the turn of the last century, these giant tuna, 700-800 pounds, were seen swimming off New Jersey and the coast of Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. Nobody knew what to do with them. You couldn't fish for them. No one could catch a fish that weighed 1,000 pounds. This was before the sort of the invention of big game fishing. And besides, when they did catch one, they didn't want to eat it. They turned it into cat food and dog food. They called them horse mackerel. And nobody ate them. The whole sushi industry developed around the late 1950s, early 1960s, with the introduction of refrigeration into Japan. Prior to the war, the Second World War, mm-hmm. prior to the war, all anybody could do with fish was pickle it or smoke it or dry it. With refrigeration, you could save it. And it was only then, sushi is not an ages-old tradition in Japan. It dates back to the 1960s.
Right, and Trevor Corson in his The Zen of Fish talks about how sushi during the early 60s was kind of like hot dog stands in New York City. I mean,
think about what the way you thought about fish before the introduction about sushi. You would no more eat a piece of raw fish than you would eat your shoelaces. And yet it has become so much of a culturally acceptable phenomenon that people buy it in delis, they buy it in takeout stores, they go to Japanese restaurants all the time. What you're eating actually is a piece of raw fish, and try to, maybe hard for some of us to do that, but try and explain to your grandmother that your favorite food is raw fish. a lot of people still don't understand how you can do that, but it has become such a craze in Japan, and Japan exports this craze. Mm-hmm. They're trying to export it to China, where there are a 1.5 billion people who don't eat raw fish, and they're trying to get them to eat raw fish, which will increase the market enormously in Japan.
Well, have you
probably raised the prices even more?
Have you been able to identify any distinguishing feature of this one fish that makes it the focal point of such a mania?
Well, let me put it this way: I've read reviews of sushi restaurants. I've eaten bluefin tuna raw and cooked.
Mm-hmm.
I've read reviews of sushi restaurants. One of them, the one I spoke about with the $600 prefix, got a 4-star review in the New York Times. Almost no restaurant gets a 4-star review in the New York Times. And the reviewer said, it is buttery and soft and fragrant, and it virtually melts in your mouth. Is it worth $1,000? Yes, he said. So there's something about it. It may be a
he must have been on an expense account, I guess, right?
Well, certainly he was sent there by an expense account. A man called Nick Toshis wrote a review of that restaurant in Vanity Fair, and he too was sent on an expense account. I couldn't talk my editors into spending $1,000 for lunch for me.
So it has become that focal point for a food mania that is centered in Japan, being exported around the world. So what is then the consequence of this mania on the wild bluefin tuna?
The consequence has been primarily in the Mediterranean, where every single country that is on the Mediterranean, from Spain to France to Italy to Greece to Croatia, Yugoslavia, Tunisia, Morocco, Algeria, every one of these countries farms bluefin tuna, and by farming, I mean they catch half-grown fish, they tow them to a pen, they release the fish into a pen, they feed them for 6 or 8 months, fatten them up, then they kill them one at a time, and they ship them all to Japan. World Wildlife Fund has called for a complete cessation of the tuna fishery in the Mediterranean because they're running out of fish, and if they run out of fish, the Japanese won't have any of those Mediterranean tuna to eat. So the result of this mania has been to increase the fishing pressure on the bluefin tuna. Everybody wants in on this this bonanza. And what has happened is they're running out of tuna all over the world. Fortunately, depending upon how you think about these things, fortunately somebody has figured out how to solve at least part of the problem.
You know, in your book, Tuna, A Love Story, you make a distinction between farming and fish and branching tuna. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by that distinction? Because, you know, here on the Pacific coast, of course, we have, and on the Atlantic coast, we have salmon farms.
Right. And salmon farms are
oops,
salmon.
Can you
raised.
Hold that? We'll pick it up when we come back from this quick break.
Okay.
And it will be the difference between fish farming and fish ranching. And what we're doing right now is ranching wild bluefin tuna. Why are we ranching them? Because they sell for tens of thousands of dollars a piece. When we get back, we're going to talk about this fishery and its impact on the wild fish and what the outlook is for wild fish of the seas. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We're talking with Richard Ellis, the author of Tuna, A Love Story. And not a bad illustration, Richard, of a wild bluefin tuna on the cover of this book. They are truly a magnificent fish. If you have a question or comment for Richard, pick up your phone and join us. 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. This is The Food Chain, and we will be right back for more. $173,000. You know, with a price tag like that on a fish, those fish are in deep doo-doo, so to speak. That deep doo-doo being the seas of the world and the fish being the bluefin tuna. And you know that they're in trouble if they have that kind of value attached to them. There's nothing going to save them. So we look for ways of farming them, and right now we're not really farming them, we're ranching them. So what's the difference between farming and ranching again, Richard Ellis?
Okay, farming is what is done with salmon and tilapia and a lot of fish around the world. You get fish to lay eggs, you collect the eggs, you raise the eggs from the smallest possible fish until they get to be market size, then you kill them and you serve them in the restaurant. That's the same thing. Farming is the same thing that happens with chickens and with cows mm-hmm. and with pigs and with sheep. You raise them from zero to adult. Ranching tuna, on the other hand, which is the practice that's going on now, is that you catch, in the wild, you catch half-grown fish, and you tow them in a pen to a corral, a floating corral in the ocean, and you tow them there, and then you keep them in that pen for 6 or 8 months, and you feed them until they get to be market size, then you kill them, then you freeze them, then you send them to Japan. So the difference is salmon, farm salmon are raised from eggs. Ranch tuna are caught half-grown. Now, what has happened in Australia is they have managed to get bluefin tuna to spawn in captivity. This may very well be the salvation of the bluefin tuna. It will change the way we think about tuna, because we like to think about wild fish
mm-hmm.
In the same way that we like to think that the salmon we're eating is wild salmon, even though the chances are that it isn't. And so we'd like to think about wild tuna, but if we're running out of wild tuna, we don't want to run out of tuna altogether. So what we're doing is, well, we're not, but the Australians are, they have got them to breed in captivity. This year, for the first time, they succeeded. In March of 2008, this company called Clean Seas in Port Lincoln, South Australia, having built a 790,000-gallon tank, that's roughly the same size as the Outer Bay tank
right,
at the Monterey Bay Aquarium, managed to replicate in that tank the water temperature, the light level, the circulation, everything that would make the tuna think that they were in their normal breeding areas in Indonesian waters. And so they spawned. They collected the eggs. Now, this is March of this year. A tuna, when it's born, is about the size of a grain of rice. So in the months that have passed since then, it certainly hasn't grown to be market size. So it'll be several years
mm-hmm.
before they know whether this has succeeded. But the idea that you can actually get tuna to breed in captivity may, as I say, be the salvation of the bluefin. We may have to domesticate them. But on the other hand, that seems to be a better idea than running out altogether, because the prices are so high that everybody is catching every tuna in the ocean and selling it to the Japanese. And they won't care whether they run out of tuna. The Japanese might care. But in fact, What's happening here is there's a kind of a flickering light at the end of this tunnel, and we may be able to save the bluefin. We may not be able to save the wild bluefin, but it certainly would be better to have bluefins breed in captivity and raise them than it is to have no tuna at all.
And if we do succeed in raising them, farming them from eggs to full-grown animals, will we then not have the opportunity to save the wild ones out there swimming free
should.
In the ocean?
We can't tell because the whole idea is so new, but we should be able to. In other words, if there's somebody raising tuna, the fishermen in the Mediterranean will not be able to compete with them.
Right.
Because it's too expensive to go fishing all the time and raise fish and feed them fish all the time, whereas if they're raised in a captive situation, the pressure might be taken off.
Hmm.
It might. We don't know. Because the idea, as I say, is just too new. But I can remember when I wrote that book, I come back from Australia, and they had not succeeded. In 2007, they had not succeeded. And I wrote in the book, oh, well, maybe they will sometime in the future. Then this year, in March, before the book was published in July, I learned that they had succeeded, and I quickly wrote this kind of newsflash and managed to get it in the book. So the book ends with
a positive.
Miraculously,
note.
They've done it.
Oh.
And so the book ends on a very positive note. A lot of it is, you know, kind of too bad we're running out of tuna. All these bad guys are killing and eating
yeah.
them.
But here's
it ends happily, at least partially happily, because we're not losing the tuna just yet.
Okay, folks, let's go to the phones. And you're going to be talking with Richard Ellis, the author of Tuna, A Love Story, here on The Food Chain with Michael Olson. Let's go to Craig. Craig, welcome to The Food Chain. Go ahead.
Hi, Michael. I just heard that your show is national now. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, I don't want to sound dumb here in front of the whole world, so I'll ask him a couple questions. I always hear the bluefin tuna is high in mercury, and then they warn about pregnant women not eating it. My second question, comment is, you know, it just seems that all these type of farming methods, you know, they raise the fish like that, tuna or salmon, they could never be anywhere as healthy as the real wild stuff. And by the way, I get this tuna over the internet. It's caught off of the Oregon coast. Is advertised, and they have right on their can low mercury. So those are my three things.
Okay, we'll pick them up when we get back from the break. Thank you for the call, Craig. Really appreciate it. Folks, you tuned into The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We've got Richard Ellis, who is the author of Tuna, A Love Story. And we have you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1980. When we get back, mercury in tuna. Well, and quality. Can you farm quality like you can catch it wild? Right back. Uh-oh. Sounds like we lost Richard Ellis there. Well, it sounds like it. We'll try it again here. Richard Ellis, are you there? No, you are not there. I guess he disappeared. Well, you might try calling him, Carol. So the question was mercury, good quality? And is it possible to have the quality that you can get in wild fish in farm fish? Mercury, I think, Richard, would be a little less afraid of than most people would in Tuna, A Love Story. He talks about how there is mercury in tuna, but if you eat it at a reasonable level, you don't have any problems with it. That in Tuna, A Love Story by Richard Ellis. Also, the question of quality, I guess that's, from my way of thinking, I don't think you can beat the wild fish. And that's just judging from the salmon that you catch from the sea as opposed to the salmon that you catch in farms. I just, boy, there is a difference in quality, and that's just me. So let's go pick up Richard. I think he's back. Are you back, Richard?
Yeah.
Oh, good. So, mercury.
Okay, mercury. Craig's asked some very, very good questions. He's hardly appearing ignorant before the world. He's appearing a whole lot smarter than most people. The mercury problem is a complicated one. Yes, there is mercury in tuna, and there's mercury in most large ocean fishes. The point is that there is mercury. Mercury is bad for you. But if you don't eat tuna three times a day, it won't harm you all that much. There was a family in San Francisco that decided that fish was brain food, so they fed their son tuna, canned tuna, three times a day for a year. And by the time they got him to the hospital, he couldn't move. His limbs didn't work. He couldn't see. He couldn't talk. He had a serious case of mercury poisoning. Mercury doesn't leave your system any more than it leaves the system of the fish that ingest it. Mercury, by the way, comes from industrial runoff of chemical plants. That's how it starts.
Right, and mines and whatnot, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, there's mercury in it, and if you don't eat that much of it, it won't hurt you. There's also omega-3 fatty acids in tuna, which are very good for you. They don't offset the mercury, certainly. Mm-hmm. But there are people who are willing to take the risk of eating a little mercury here and there to get the omega-3 fatty acids.
Well, what about farmed fish? Can you farm fish?
Well, that seems to me a matter of taste. There are a lot of people that claim to be able to tell the difference between farmed and wild salmon. Quite often they get it wrong. It probably is better, although it's hard to figure out why. If you feed tuna in captivity, the same kind of fish they eat in the wild, since they can't stop moving, they're constantly exercising, so they're not lying around watching television. So they get the same amount of exercise. They sort of have to, because if they don't, they'll be dead. So they get exercise. They eat the same kind of food. Maybe their mental state is not as happy because they're in captivity.
Or maybe more happy. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? Maybe they like being in captivity, getting fed twice a day.
We have just a few seconds left, but let me ask you to look into the future, Richard Ellis, because you've really looked into the history and the significance of the tuna. Do you see our oceans becoming vast farms of fish?
First of all, I see our oceans being depleted of the wild fish that we eat. There are many parts of the oceans where the food fishes that people depended on for centuries are gone.
So 10 seconds left. What do you think?
I don't think they will become vast farms. I think some parts of them will become farms. Let me put it this way. If they don't become farms,
we're
going to
be
eating jellyfish sandwiches.
Richard Ellis, Tuna, A Love Story. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was great.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.